Well, I think we'll go ahead and start. And first, my apologies for being, well, missing the last 2 days. Most of you know, my mother broke her ankle on Tuesday and went down to Chelan on Wednesday, had surgery yesterday, and coming back here for a day or two, and then I'm going back down to Chelan. Well, the idea was for this session to be sort of the grand finale of 5 days on Christianity and African politics, or African Christianity and politics, looking at five different individuals in Africa over time whose faith influenced their involvement in politics in some fashion. And so Lema Boye was meant to be sort of bringing us up chronologically to the present, and also meant to build in the previous sessions, and that I believe there are certain patterns in how African Christianity manifests itself in politics, in terms of shaming leaders into acting and behaving in certain ways. And that's the one question I would. And actually, one of the sessions I was going to do yesterday, we're going to do it tomorrow. So chronologically, we'll back up a little bit. We'll still have a chance to talk about South Africa. So that's one question I would pose there is, you know, is if there is such a thing as a Christian government, is democracy one characteristic of a Christian government? You know, what does that even mean, if there is such a thing? So with this, I thought, and it's working out well since I caught a cold as well, limited energy, but I thought we would focus on the video now, because first of morning, how many people saw the video either last night or some other time? Okay, good. That's what I was sort of anticipating. But in the eventuality that perhaps some people hadn't seen it, basically what I thought we would do today is, from on the DVD, there's several bonus features, and one of them is an interview made on PBS with Lema Boye and the director of the film, where they basically asked various questions about the making of the film, about Lema's own life story, about what is the significance of the film, and so forth. So that was a good way to, one, because it includes excerpts from the film as they refer to the film, and you see the excerpt they're talking about. But then also, it's very interesting to see them kind of critique it on their own about what is its significance. I mean, towards that end, then I imagine some of you have also read her autobiography, which came out recently, Mighty Be Our Powers. And this is one passage from it that I thought was particularly revealing, sort of a turning point, as it were, in her life story, where she's kind of been building up to this confrontation, and then finally she and this women's group in Ghana, in Accra, confront the negotiations, negotiations to end the civil war in Liberia had stalled. Things were looking pretty bleak, and just in this moment of absolute frustration, she begins to protest this by stripping. Starts to strip, and it's interesting, okay, now why would this be such a turning point? And she addresses that in this quote, as well as in the video, so we can talk about it afterwards. But I thought that was a pivotal moment, so I reproduced the passage here. Just a little bit, I mean, I don't want to give you a whole history lecture, but in case you're wondering about the context here, we're talking about Liberia, which, again, I think compelled to explain about Africa again. Africa is not one place. Obviously, it's a huge territory. There's a state of Washington to the same scale. So you think about how long it takes to cross and drive from one end of Washington to the other, from Spokane to Seattle with a four-lane highway. Transpose that to the same distance, say, across, you know, Ghana from north end to south, you know, on a dirt road, and you get an idea of how, you know, vast and expansive it is. So it's just incredibly culturally diverse. The stats I always share, I mean, it's got a fourth of the world's countries, a third of the world's languages, because human beings have been here twice as long as anywhere else, half the world's human genetic diversity. So it's an incredibly diverse place linguistically. Languages within Africa can be as distinct from each other as Chinese and Finnish. I mean, it's just, so, you know, don't ask, you know, what do Africans speak, or what is the African way to do something, even if it could be problematic. So that's the thing with Liberia, with Sierra Leone. I think the tendency is, and this, I think they address this in the video as well, and I guess maybe I'll share my own opinion on this right off the bat. I mean, I think the predominant view of Africa, the only news of Africa that tends to make Western media, is that of death and destruction, famine, starvation, and most prominently in the last 5 years is between like 1995 and 2005, was in West Africa, in the area of Liberia, Sierra Leone. Right, so they had a terrible, terribly brutal civil war that wasn't just in Liberia, but actually kind of spanned this border region between Guinea, Cote d'Ivoire, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And it was sort of trans-border for that reason. It's like the rebel groups just run to the neighboring country, and it was very easy to elude the governments that they're fighting against. And it was partly fueled by diamond mining in that same region. So it got a lot of attention eventually, but just to keep, you know, things in perspective, the majority of countries in Africa are actually quite peaceful, and have been peaceful for most of the history. That's when you think of Africa as this huge war-torn area, that's a misperception. I mean, currently in Africa, you do have some violence, you know, in Sudan, Ethiopia, but it's really, you know, if you drew little lines around those areas experiencing political violence right now, you'd see it's a very small percentage of the country. But, you know, peace and prosperity just aren't newsworthy. And we'll talk more about that, why this media attention on violence in Africa. So anyways, for your own sort of background, I'm not going to go through all this. There's a little timeline I came up with, sort of major events in Liberia's history, and how this women's movement that is highlighted in the film really kind of peaked in 2003. I'm sorry, 2003, where they finally had these peace talks in July, ultimately culminating in Taylor stepping down, Charles Taylor, and going into exile. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and then all of us, then last year, Lema Gbagbo and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf jointly won the Nobel Peace Prize. But then also, Kawakol Karman of Yemen was the third recipient of that Peace Prize last year. All women working for peace. Although there's some controversy with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. She was recently, you know, convicted of collusion with Charles Taylor, so becomes a little problematic. All right, and then these are just some questions that came to my mind, but we can have a whole other set of questions. So I think what I'm going to do is just going to, or first, I don't know if I have any questions or comments before I show this video. So it ticks, yeah.
Well, I will say she's quite a speaker here. We get to hear her. Have any of the women here heard her? Because she's been to some of the, she was at Salt Lake, she was at several of the women's meetings.
Right, right.
Northwest Washington Synod women had her. And so then, the week she got the Nobel Prize last year, she was in Seattle. Mm. So we had her at our church, and then she was at Town Hall. And so, if you ever get to hear her, she's a tremendous speaker. She's just very interesting. And the book has a lot of other things about her personal life.
Right.
And you see this film, and then you read all the stuff she went through in the book.
Right, right.
That isn't in here at all.
Right, right. They don't really give you the personal background.
Well, they don't have time.
Right, right.
What a story.
That's true, yeah. She addresses a little bit in this interview, but right.
But not her real personal details of kids and guys, right. Everything she went through.
Yeah, six children now, three different fathers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, she feels she's not at all a paragon of virtue, and that's, I guess, part of the, you know, the irony of that. Sorry, I'm just going to show this interview then, and we'll have some time after we talk about this. So, any other preliminary questions, comments?
Okay. This is an eye-opening account of a pivotal moment in history that somehow managed to evade most Americans' radar screens. The producer of Pray the Devil Back to Hell is Abigail Disney. She is the founder and president of the Daphne Foundation, an organization that helps fund groups working with low-income neighborhoods in New York City. This is her first film. Lema Gbagbo is now executive director of Women, Peace, and Security Network Africa, WIPSEN, based in Accra, Ghana. She is also the mother of five, very soon six, children. Welcome to both of you. It's such an honor to have you here.
Thank you.
Lema, this was not a conventional war in any sense of the word that we might think of. You talk about what happened to women and children in particular. Children were conscripted, kidnapped, forced to be fighters, forced to do unspeakable things to family members. Women were raped regularly. Rape was a weapon of war. You refer to it as hell on earth.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there is no other description, because when you read about hell, there is nothing explicit about the word hell that says joy. And that was the life we lived, no joy. You wake up in the morning and you're just wondering, what is going to be different today? Am I going to be shot as I walk the street? Or is my younger brother going to be conscripted? Or am I going to be raped? You know, every day you wake up and there was one terrible thing after the other, seeing people being taken off the line and being killed. And then early morning, you wake up and someone comes to you and say, remember your classmate you graduated with like 3 months ago? This morning, the entire family was slaughtered. You know, those were the kinds of things that we grew up with. There is no description. There is no way that you can call this life. Death at one point was better than life.
It was always like you go to bed and pray that you have something different the next day. You know, that the shooting will stop, that the killing will stop, that the hunger will stop, saying, God, please. I had a dream, and it was like a crazy dream. Someone was actually telling me to get the women of the church together to pray for peace. This is completely a terrible life to live. We are tired. We are tired. But then I said the dream, was like more ideas kept coming.
And great leaders are doing this. We feel it's not time to rise up and speak, but we do want to do this every week. We want to invite the other Christian churches to come and let's put our voices together.
And we started the Christian Women Peace Initiative.
We asked people who are going to be our savior, Mother Mary, mother, grandmother, aunt, sister. For us, this is just the beginning.
You say in the film, I had a dream. A crazy dream. What turned you from being essentially a victim, someone trying to get through all this, to wanting to take some action?
When I had that dream, I felt so oddly placed because I always say I was the wrong person for God to be speaking to and for bringing the women of the churches together, because I wasn't like a 100% Holy Ghost filled Christian, doing all of the right things. I was doing everything wrongly, and I felt if I had to speak to someone, I had to be someone perfect.
Wait a minute, you're saying to me that you had to be convinced that you were the one to do something?
Exactly, I had to be, because I was terrified. When I had that dream, I went to tell my friend that we need to get these women together. And then she said, yeah, I said, but we need to call the women of the churches and find a leader. So when we called them, they were like, you are the leader. And I'm like, no, God just told me to tell you all. Because life. And the older women were like, haven't you read about a prostitute in the Bible that God used? Haven't you read about a sinner, a woman that Jesus encountered? And then it went on and on and on. I was like, you don't understand. It can't be me. I was a single parent, and in my church, I could not excel to any position of authority because I wasn't married. And you constantly hear things being badgered into your head that women who are not married and have children are the worst sinners, and you're fornicating and you're committing adultery and all of the different things. So I was like, I don't want to be a part of this thing. But after they convinced me, we started this journey together, then I realized that every problem we encounter on this journey, I'm going to rise above it and lead these women because they trusted me with their lives and their future.
Abby, how did you and Jimmy Redeker, who is the director that you partnered with, how did the two of you first hear about the story?
Well, I had gone to Liberia, you know, just as a philanthropist, just to see if I could be helpful for funding. And then I sort of heard the story. I mean, I would talk to this one and that one, and people would mention it in passing. And it was the strangest thing, because everybody gave me a little sliver of a story. And I knew something very important had occurred, but it was hard to put all the slivers together and figure out exactly what the story was. And so I collected them sort of and asked, And on my very last night there, I said to this one guy who was from the EU, and his last night there, and he had a couple of scotches, and he said, sure, those women were amazing, you know, and we wouldn't be sitting here in peace if it hadn't been for them. So I thought, wow, now, if this story is true, and I was still skeptical, it would make an extraordinary documentary.
What did you see in Lena and in the market women? I mean, these are just ordinary women, right?
Yeah. Well, that's what I thought in them. First of all, I mean, I had been doing a lot of work in New York with grassroots women's organizations, and so I had a sense that all around us, like magically invisible, are these incredible people who do amazing things all the time, and you just have to know where to look for them. So I think I was prepared to see the power and the ability to lead in these women because my eyes had been made ready for it by the work that I've done for years in New York City. So I recognized the special language that was being spoken there.
Was there a turning point in your life where you understood that it was the women who could make the difference?
Yeah. From 17 up until 20-something, I went around with this big chip on my shoulder that was a victim of war. Until I started working at the kids work with a group of women from Sierra Leone, Liberia. And these women have different forms of disability. They have stories that no one could understand. But every time I went to meet with that group of women, they were always like, when the war is over, I'm going to do this. When the war ends, I had gotten to a point where I was saying, I'm not going to college. I'm not doing anything. I'm not going to invest any positive thing in my life because one bullet can take it all away. So, but then you hear these women, there's this one woman who had this very horrible story, but she still had that smile on her face. When I get back to the community, I'm going to put the children together, and I'm going to teach them how to dance. And then one day I'm like, why are you people so optimistic about life? And then they said, because we believe as mothers, we are the ones who will change everything. Went back home and said to myself, aren't you a hypocrite? Yes, you went through some hell in this war, but not as much as those women. You need to stop acting like a victim and get up and do something, not just for you, but for those women.
What made you think that the market women were the ones that could make the difference?
You know, when we started interacting with these women, one of the things I realized was the untapped power that they had. These were the people who knew when the fighters were going to attack. These were the people who just knew by sitting at the market table, strange movement, and then go to people they trust and say, pack your things and leave, because danger is imminent. These are the people who could talk to the fighters. And then again, on the negative front, these were the women who were moving weapons from one community to the other in their bundles. So they knew when the war was coming, they knew how they were going to be, and they knew the fighters, and they could stop whatever was happening in the different communities. So, and no one, not the UN, not all of the conflict and the analysts, and none of them ever figured that these group of people had what it took. And then there was also the full factor of numbers.
There are a lot of them.
Yeah.
And one of the extraordinary things you did was that you got, for the first time, Christian and Muslim women together.
Yeah.
How did you pull that off?
Well, we had a lot in our favor, because by the time we started the Christian Women Peace Initiative, Asatu, who's a Muslim in the film, Asatu is now the deputy inspector general of police in Liberia. She went to Christian school, so she was never afraid to be in gatherings. But when she saw this, she was like, I'm going to do this. Are you going to walk with me? And I said, I'll walk with you. When we started every Friday after prayers, going to these women, talking to them, they had a serious impediment in that Muslim women had never really been involved overtly in activism, because some of the imams had managed to misconstrue or to do the Quran in a way that your place is at home. You can't. But we had this one imam who understood. And so we just, every time we saw someone who was like in favor or just gave us a signal that
they could be in favor of, we exploited that relationship.
And you've got these women together, which is amazing. Yeah. You have many sit-ins at the marketplace. And then you got to the point where you had a meeting with Charles Keller, which must have been terrifying. And I want to talk about that. But first, let's see that face-to-face meeting with the then Liberian president, Charles Keller.
Taylor could no longer ignore us. Finally, he decided to meet with us. Some of the women, they was really afraid to go to the mansion and to see Taylor.
People were just edging and edging and edging, and people were feeling faint. And then we realized that it was fear of the unknown. Going to meet Taylor that day was a moment that I lived for. When Lima got on stage to meet his Taylor, we were like holding hands and praying. We say, Jesus gave her the strength. I said, we rebuke any evil force that will make her weak.
Let Freeman Bowie, coordinator of the Women Peace Building Network.
We ask the Honorable President of the Senate, being a woman and being in line with our cause, to kindly present this statement to His Excellency, Dr. Charles Taylor, with this message that the women of Nigeria, including the IPT, we are tired of war. We are tired running. We are tired begging for bubbles. We are tired of our children being raped. We are now taking this stand to secure the future of our children, because we believe as custodians of society tomorrow, our children will ask us, Mama, what was your role during the crisis? Kindly convey this to the President of Nigeria. Thank you.
You know what strikes me about that so much? That you keep saying kindly. Will you kindly present this to Mr. Taylor, to the President? This was a man who had ruined the country, killed people, murdered people, kidnapped children. Kindly?
Well, at one point watching the clip, when I said, present this to His Excellency, there was a pause. And that pause was looking for a word, because it was either the idiot or the evil man. But I was trying, because there was so much anger at that point, which, strangely, I think the prayers of the women worked, because I was really angry, just standing there and looking at this man that had caused so much pain to the Liberian people. It was a difficult moment, and there was no way that I would have read that politically correct statement that those women drafted so well without adding the true feeling, the feeling that we're tired being raped, we're tired begging for food. And then at some point I realized that standing there, this is the moment that will determine whether we will be free or our children will continue this struggle after we're dead and gone. So it was a terrifying moment for me that morning, because I didn't know how many women would turn up. And when we got the numbers that we got, it really made me bold.
And the women sitting on the floor, there was a reason for them sitting on the floor, right?
Oh, yeah. Even us, when we got up to where he was sitting, he offered us seats. And we said no. And Sugar had earlier on said, got up and spoke to him and said, if you see us refusing seats, it's not because we want to be disrespectful to you, but we want to let you know that when the bombs and the guns are shooting, we will not run with chairs. We don't run with mattresses. Whatever we see, so we are preparing ourselves for everything that our sisters are going through right now.
How did you get the footage of the women with Charles Taylor. That was such a powerful moment.
That is an incredible moment. And we have really been struggling to find footage. We went to every source we could find, and we would get hours and hours of footage of people shooting each other and just horrible things. We had just hours of it to the point where we couldn't watch it anymore. And we just could not find anything of these women protesting.
Why not?
No. We all know why in our hearts. Because if these women did not look or sound or seem like they mattered. For reasons of gender, for reasons of class, education, convention. For a lot of reasons, these women have very deliberately not chosen to dress and frame themselves in a certain kind of way. And so therefore, they were being dismissed. I mean, we were told by journalistic photographers who were there, yes, I saw the women, they just were so pathetic looking, there was no point in shooting them. So all of our footage in the film that is of women, not of men shooting each other, there was plenty of that that came from the news sources, but of women constructively protesting for peace came from private individuals who had their little tiny Betamax camera with them, and we'd get some footage from that. But on our, I think our second to last night during principal photography in Monrovia, someone said to me, you know, maybe you should call this guy. And I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know who he was. I just knew he was somebody who had done some footage. And so he came to our hotel, and it turns out that he had been the official videographer for the presidential palace since before the original coup, all the way through President Sirleaf's election. And he had been basically downsized out of his job in 2006. And he went home with all of his ministers. So he had been there. For coups, assassinations, and mortar fire on the presidential palace, and all of the almost like Shakespearean ins and outs in the background of that presidential palace, and he had every inch of it on tape. It was really extraordinary.
Lev, I have to ask, the first time you saw the footage of this event that had clearly been so important in your life, what was it like to watch yourself doing that?
I was like, wow. Can I do that? Can I see that? Because it was almost like we were in another time in another world. 2003 was definitely another time in another world. And it took this film to really not just bring me back, but all of the women we have seen bring us back to where we've been. And if there was ever a think of, I don't want to work hard anymore, I just want to retire and take care of my kids. The film has really brought us to the place where we're saying, you know, we don't want to go back to this world, you know, this world that we found ourselves in. So it's a good reminder. It was also a good reminder that we have done something for our society. And that's why I feel forever in gratitude to Abby Jeannie for doing this film, not just because of me, but because there's something that our daughters can look back at and say, we're proud of our mothers.
Tell that, Arthur.
My kids saw the film for the first time, and when they saw that scene with Taylor, my now 13-year-old son said, weren't you afraid? How foolish would you have been? You know, literally saying to me, you could have been killed. If I had known that you were going to meet him, I would have told you not to go, because your life would have been in danger. So, I mean, this just to show you that different understanding of, yeah. Before you ask my kids, what does your mommy do? They'll tell you she travels around.
And now they're not it.
Yeah.
Charles Taylor, you had that meeting with Charles Taylor. You presented your statement. How did you get from there to the peace talks in Ghana?
Taylor, yeah, said from the beginning that he wasn't going to sit with the rebels at any peace table. But that was the first time he made a public commitment after we met with him that he was going to meet with the rebels in Ghana.
from the killers arriving here.
On a peace talk that we begin today, governed between the warring factions in Latvia, there's been pressure on both sides to end a war which has destabilized much of West Africa. It'll be the first time that Latvian President Charles Taylor has talked with the rebel movements which are now trying to oust him.
The women living in the refugee camp joined our delegation when we got to Ghana. We realize that if we stay back in Liberia, the whole thing, idea of the struggle will be in vain, because we had to be present there at the peace talk, letting them know. Because when we started the protest, the idea was that we needed for the West, for the media to see that there was another population to this story, there was another side to the story, the women and children that were affected. Because all we saw on CNN were footages of fighting and bombing and interviews with Taylor and the rebel leaders. And we wanted them to see that they were victims to all of this glorified media attention that you were giving to these boys with guns. We were victims. So we thought if we stayed back and didn't go to Accra, we would have defeated our purpose. So we just started getting donations from little groups here and there, and we got maybe $6,000. By the time we bought tickets, we had $100,000 to live on, and we thought we were going to be in Ghana for 2 weeks, but we were there for 3 months.
And how did you pay for your hotels? How did you get food?
I had a house, 2-bedroom house in Ghana, so I had 10 people already living in that house, plus the 7 women that had gone to Accra. So we were 17 sleeping in a 2-bedroom house, all in the hallway, and living off of what my kids ate every day, and going and coming back. But what we thought was, no matter how bad it got, we always sustained a presence at the peace talks.
And then all the sides have agreed to negotiate an end to the war, or wars, finally. You sent a delegation to the talks, right? And organized women to protest. And then you really took matters into your own hands. Let's look at that incredible moment.
So I told Sugars, today is showdown. Send for more women. So I told the women to stand at the door and look arm, one arm within the other. And the next thing we heard on the overhead speaker was, oh my God, distinguished ladies and gentlemen, the peace hall has been seized by General Lima and her troops.
They really came and locked us in that nobody would come out until that peace agreement was signed, even if it means staying there for days.
And then the security guard came, who is the leader of this group. I stood up and said, here am I. And he said, you are obstructing justice. And that word, obstructing justice, was almost like when you took gas and just pour it on an open flame. I just went, wow. I said, obstructing justice? He said, yes, and we're going to arrest you. I said, okay, I'm going to make it very, very easy for you to arrest me. I took off my hair tie.
It's a curse in Africa to see the naked body of your mother.
Anyway, look at me, I'm going to strip naked.
Especially if she does it deliberately.
Elima had started speaking out when I came out. She really was saying, look, you guys will do this, or this is what we're going to do.
That's it, I will listen to you, my people. Yeah. These people come here, everyone gets their big bed. When they came, they were all pale, no eating their bush. Now they are wearing fine Ghanaian male textiles. And they are passing around telling us we will kill their people.
When we go back, we're appropriate. They won't come out. Today they will be there. Oh, wow. People are feeling there. Hey,
General. One of the warlords came to the door and tried to jump over the women. And the women pushed him back, and he went back as if he was about to kick their backs.
Please.
And General Abu Bakr said to him, hey, I dare you. Try it. So go back in there and sit down. They came to the second. He said, I said, go and sit down. If you were a real man, you won't be killing your people. But because you are not a real man, that's why they will treat you like boys. Go back, and I dare anyone leave this hall until we've negotiated with these women.
I'm going to have my meeting. And then I'm going to meet you in the evening at 6 o'clock. After that, then we'll get our heads together.
Complaining that negotiators were making little progress, Liberian women staged a sit-in, blocking delegates from leaving the conference hall.
If this day is just prolonging, in our opinion, this thing, in their quest for power, in their quest for this whole thing of authority in Liberia, and that we're going to keep them in that room without water, without food, so that they at least feel what the ordinary people in Liberia are feeling at this particular point in time.
So we went, accompanied by the Ghanaian ambassador, accompanied by other people, and for 30 minutes it was just like tears and tears. Finally, he said, you have to let your women out of their self, no.
Well, we're not leaving, because if we then, he will have to take all of us, and there were almost 200 of us.
But ironically, the very security that were arresting me a few minutes earlier, were the same security that came and said, you have to send some women to the window because some of the delegates are jumping out of the window. And then we said, General, if we remove these women, we give these guys 2 weeks or we will do it again.
It's just astounding. Where did you come up with the idea of stripping?
That woman of rage. I mean, when you've been disgraced and you've been walked on, when your pride has been just, there is nothing left, when people think they're taking everything from you, you decide you're giving them some of what they thought they're taking away. I feel that's the greatest pain any woman can feel. So at that moment, here am I barricading a hall where you have a bunch of people who have killed about people for 14 years. And here are these guys living in a quote-unquote peaceful country, and they are arresting me for obstructing justice. There was, for me at that moment, the world had turned into something that I never knew. You know what, you grew up knowing that this is a just world, this is a peaceful world, this is a world where people care about each other. That moment was like, this is a world where no one cares. And if they don't care, you should not care. You do whatever you can do to get people to know that you're hurting.
I had the most extraordinary moment during the shooting of the film when we had an opportunity to sit with one of the warlords who'd been present at the peace talks. And I asked him, how is it possible in a country where 50% of the women have been raped for one woman threatening to strip naked to cause such mayhem? I don't understand. And he said, you have to understand they were our mothers. And the only way your mother would do that is if she were driven to total desperation. And there was something in that moment there that caused every man in that room, no matter what he'd done during the conflict, to ask himself, what have I done? What have I done to get us here? And talk about changing the dynamic of the room. You know, that was the last thing on earth that would have happened in the hearts of those men had the women taken the place in the room, had they abandoned the moral discourse, had they let it go and acted the way they were being persuaded to act. And I really do believe that, you know, the majority of conflicts, you know, in any place, Africa, anywhere, are really made possible by, you know, there's a core group of bad guys, you know, and there's a Charles Taylor in every one of them who really can't be penetrated, who really is, you know, a sociopath or a person without a conscience, and is, you know, almost inexplicable to us. But a person alone can't make these systems run. He needs to be supported by these expanding concentric circles of supporters who really are not all of them as impenetrable, and who are, for one reason or another, kind of slouching into the moral system, and they live kind of this life of bad faith. You know, I think in their hearts they know they're doing the wrong thing, but there's more money in it, or there's more power in it, or this is just easier.
So how does something like what the women do did, in terms of going to their core beliefs as women, how does that get to them?
I think that this is much like, it's like a dog whistle frequency. I think that our mother's voices have a moral and emotional frequency that penetrates all of the layers and all of the frames that we use to conduct ourselves in these rooms according to these tacit agreements that we have, that we all think are making things more smooth.
So the men were reacting to the most primal thing, which is they were responding to their mothers.
To me, I think they were just restored to themselves. It was like the magician at the end of the hypnosis session snapping his fingers. They remembered who they were, they remembered what they were doing there, and they were brought back to something. And that is what made moving forward in these peace talks possible.
As far as you can tell, was this something that was planned, or did this just come out of their decision to do this as women, as mothers, as outsiders from the beginning?
Well, Lima, what do you think? Was that planned?
A lot of the things we did weren't really like planned, but every day what we did was, after we did one action, we sat down and analyzed how effective it was. So it wasn't just protesting and going to sleep at night. So if we were there till 12 midnight, we would still find 1 hour to sit to evaluate the work that we did. That was one strategy that we used from the beginning. So every day, the protest got better. All of the sluggish things we started with on the first day, we didn't repeat on the second day and on the third day. So it just got from one stage of being strategic to the other. And then I had read different, and myself and some of the other women had read different nonviolent action. I read King, I read Gandhi, I had read about the Nigerian women seizing the shell oil place in Nigeria, in the Niger Delta, different things, and people brought different ideas every day. And as we did these things, we came back and said, let's look at this differently, let's look at this differently.
One of my regrets in making the film was that we weren't able to show all of the richness and the thinking and the strategy behind the movement, because there was, you know, so much strategy and thinking and planning in it. And, you know, it is really, in effect, a classic example of nonviolent resistance in the vein of everything that Gandhi and Martin Luther King ever planned. And Gandhi famously said, you know, first they ignore you, then they make fun of you, then they try to hurt you, and then they deal with you. And that is precisely how the movement progressed. All they were asking for was something that was essentially kind of conservative, which was, let's just make these systems work. Let's just hold these systems accountable to the promises they made. They weren't asking to turn the world upside down. They were just asking people to do their job. And the pivotal moment when security comes to arrest her, and she threatens to strip naked, and they refuse to arrest her. It's classic Gandhi nonviolence, where the power equation is flipped in a moment. And it's so extraordinary, and we've seen it in so many places. And the more we see it, I think the more often we'll see it. You know, making it visible, making it available to people will bring it out in places we can't even begin to imagine.
What you did in Ghana worked, and you were largely responsible, your group, for finally ending the fighting. The war was over. There was an election. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the first female elected head of state in Africa, is now the president of Liberia.
I want to here now gratefully acknowledge the powerful voice of women for all walks of life. Whose votes brought us the victory. They defended me. They worked with me. They prayed for me. It is the women who labored and advocated for peace throughout our region.
The president wrote in her book, and I quote, before her campaign, she said she would go to various places to campaign and women would say to her, men have failed us. People would say to her, men are too violent, too prone to make war. Women are less corrupt, less likely to be focused on getting fancy cars and fancy homes for themselves. Is that true, do you think? Were men more corrupt? Are men more corrupt than women?
When the president made that statement, it's at the end of this wonderful campaign that women had carried out. And it was the men who recognized that if these women could change this situation around, let's give them the chance to lead this country. So even when we were not interested in the political discourse, communities that we went in, it was the men who were encouraging us, you need to do something. You need to take a seat in parliament. You need to get to this point. You need to get to that point. So when they started, because they recognized within themselves that they had failed, not just themselves, but they failed the women and the children of Liberia. So that was a common theme. And in all fairness, yes, the women said it, but it was the men who were even pushing that message out the loudest.
You know, I think that there's really, really important moment there in the film is when General Abu Bakr says, if you were a real man, you wouldn't be killing your people. You go in there and sit down, and they'll treat you like boys. I've had, you know, when we've shown it for high schools, very often the high school boys will come and say, I don't see any good men. Where are the good men in this film? And I say, actually, there are lots of good men in the film if you really look. They're carrying out the dead. They're carrying their grandmothers on their backs and their babies in their arms. And they're stepping up and saying, you know, you're not a real man. That's not what it looks like. So I think that there's an interesting thing here happening in terms of those good men who are quite invisible to us, even though they're right in plain sight. And so I think that we have to remember that the room where these peace talks are taking place and the room at a larger metaphorical level where power takes place isn't inclusive of women, but it's also not inclusive of all kinds of men. They're not all in that room either. So when we talk about wanting to shift the idea of power and saying, you know, we need to find other ways to the bargaining table besides shooting your way there, we need to recognize all the stakeholders. We're talking about opening those peace talks up to all of those people who have been destroyed, really, by a small, tiny interpretation of masculinity. Which has taken up an enormous amount of space throughout history and throughout our political happenings.
The president of the country has expressed her gratitude to you and to the Smiling. That's a wonderful achievement for you, to you and to the other market women who really helped make this happen. What do you want from her and what do you want next in Liberia?
I would like to see 4 years, 3 years from now, after Madam Sirleaf has left office, that those policies and laws that we've been struggling for, that will give me equal easy access to some of the issues that we've been fighting for many years, are on the books. That at the end of the day, it's there, written in black and white. At the end of the day, we don't have to continue the fight. Because I know that after her presidency, that is when we're going to have the war between the men and the women. Because sadly, a lot of the politicians are cowards. Now that we have peace and quiet, most of the men now want to step in and say, we've given them 6 years, so they should go back to 150 years more of sitting home and taking care of their children. Sometimes you walk and people say to you, especially me, if I'm at the airport and some of the security personnel say, well, Ms. Bowie, you did a good job And 6 years from now, we're going to take it back, you know, because we've given you all your chance.
Giving you all, meaning you women.
Yes. So I think that's where the true war and the true division is going to be, because it's going to be women versus men. So one of the things that I would like to see is in our electoral law, where you have 30% affirmative action for women, if not 40%. I would also, one of my wish lists, and the president has been working with us on this, is going from one county to the other and really empowering young girls to see politics not as a thing for loose women, because that's the stereotype we have in Liberia, that it's only loose women, women who can keep their husbands are the ones who are involved in politics, or they either kill their husbands in order to get involved in politics. So we want, we're doing this, and we hope that we can continue to do this until the next 3 years of our presidency, get more women, get more young girls to see leadership, not as a privileged thing, but as a thing that she's entitled to, that not as a privileged thing for men, but as something that she is also entitled to. So those are all little things that we would like to see. On the other front, I would like to see her kicking more butts on the whole issue of corruption, because you hear it there, it's there every day. You don't want, one of the things we always say as African feminists, as women working in Liberia, Africa, Ghana, and different parts, Ellen is not just the hope, expectation, and aspiration for Liberian women, for African women. Depending on what she does, these 6 years will have a great impact on the continent. We're seeing it happening in different parts of the world. Women are now saying we're stepping out there. People are now comparing Liberia to other parts. We just saw the elections in Ghana. The president had the toughest time because he had to appoint equal number of women as men into key positions. So we need, the hope and the aspiration is just for the entire continent, Africa, and other places where women are underprivileged and underrepresented.
And in fact, when I was there, there were women.
It's okay, there's still a few more minutes left, but I guess I'd like to allow some time for discussion. Or we can keep going. But now they talk about showing the field to other parts of the world.
That there is something called the gender ministry. We don't have one here in this country. She said,
yeah, what they go on to talk about now is that the film went on tour around the world, and then about Bosnia and was, so I guess maybe just reactions to the film, or are there points that you found surprising or startling? Or
what do you know about, you said a little bit about Ellen Jones and Sirley, the film itself, it makes it, I think, very evident why Lema Boy would have been a nominee for the Peace Prize, what role did Ellen Johnson Sirleaf play? Because there's nothing in the film about her in this whole process.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I'm not even sure what the rationale was. I think some of it may have been that she, when she played a role, I think as part of the negotiations, that she sort of emerged from this as sort of acknowledged, also the moral authority, I guess. I mean, that she, you know, was seen as being as untainted from the Civil War. But that's now it's been emerged. She was a member of Charles Taylor's government, so there's still questions about that, like how innocent was she really? But I think that's a good question, because I mean, at the time when these other women were putting their lives in line, she was not. So I'm not entirely sure. Does anybody know why she was included in
that? No, that was the question last October, kind of, what's going on here? Because she doesn't seem to be somebody who contributed a lot, other than statistically, she's the first woman president, things like that.
Those might be along the same lines as Barack Obama. There's more anticipation of things to come, perhaps, than previous accomplishments. I think that's some of what it was. It was just to acknowledge and support and to sort of acclaim Liberia, you know, in having taken the step.
You know, just the whole Nobel Peace Prize process. I mean, how many people are really want to do this? I mean, there are a ton of people out there.
Right.
How do they come down to those ultimate decisions?
Yeah, and two.
This one makes you wonder.
Yeah, two from Liberia too. It's like they're going to do Yemen and two. You know, they could. There's plenty of other countries where women are putting their lives on the line. So. Their reactions are awkward. Well, one thing that came to my mind was they're trying to explain why is this. I mean, that. I don't think the answer either. It's like, why is it these men in the context of this negotiation room suddenly, who, you know, months earlier, years earlier, you know, had been parties to and profiting from all kinds of atrocities, and now suddenly they're listening to this so-called, you know, this dog whistle of their mother's voice. I mean, I don't know if you guys buy that or not. Is this motherhood, is this mother power that finally turns the tide?
Well, I'm not sure how organized some of them were anyway. You know, some of them had gotten rid of politics out of the war scene. Mm-hmm. And the film itself, how many of some of them had not been particularly involved at all, all of a sudden they're in there.
Right.
In charge, or, you know, whatever.
Right, opportunistically, you know, yeah, the negotiation, the critique of it is that, as so many negotiations, it wasn't about, you know, building a sustainable peace as it was, who gets what piece of the pie.
Well, we did learn even more from negotiating. I mean, in some ways, felt we had the upper hand long term.
Yeah, yeah. That had nothing to gain from negotiating.
So I think sometimes people get in situations where what they really need is a way out.
Mm.
I mean, they're kind of in the middle of it, it's a mess. And really, what she did was sort of offer them a way out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for whatever reason, it was maybe it was a relief.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Rather than posturing and being afraid to back down and kind of a masculine kind of thing. I mean, that was one of the questions I asked. I don't know if it has an answer or not. I mean, on my fourth question, can one characterize some forms of political activism as being particularly quote-unquote feminine, or take it, you know, other ways, or African or Christian? If so, what differentiates them from masculine, Western, or secular politics? Is one more effective than the other? There's all kinds of questions wrapped up in there. Is this feminine politics triumphing over masculine
politics of frustration?
Mm-hmm.
Like how long they've been abused, particularly men.
Yeah. Because I wonder if it was men blocking the hall, whether it would. I mean, my sense is that it would not have the same reaction. It would have all been carted away.
Well, we're looking at a snapshot.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of other things going on.
Right.
Looked like it was evident in the film that those nations around Liberia were tired of the situation. So the women were a catalyst, and then you got the political support to the point where Charles Taylor said, okay, I'm gone.
Right.
And rest assured, he's gone with a phenomenal amount of wealth and is probably not unduly suffering.
That's true. Even the scene they showed in Ghana, ultimately it was the former Nigerian president who seems to, you know, step in and intervene on the side of the women, and is the, you know, backs them up and gives their protest a little more weight. Yeah, they don't really talk about that. The behind the scenes about Nigeria, about South Africa, about the French and the Americans were all, you know, putting their chips on different people, hoping that this thing would.
And the reason they were was because of the attention the women raised in their protests, or part of, you know, so I don't need to discount the role of the women.
Well, that's, I mean, that's the one part that I mentioned before the video, too, I guess, being familiar with some other events in other parts of Africa, and in those parts that don't make the news, is, I thought that was pretty telling, that, you know, the Western photojournalists were all focusing on the atrocities, you know, the child soldiers, the destroyed villages, and just kind of ignored this, what seemed to be a pathetic kind of, you know, protest against that. Or does that, I guess, what does that say about African politics or Western attitudes? I mean, why would the photojournalists do that? What impact does that have on how things unravel in Africa?
How much difference is the reporting in this country?
Right, that's true. Yeah.
I gotta say, I work with hundreds of teenagers who observe the same thing.
Mm.
They are at school, working hard, producing fabulous music, and it never makes the media. But one of them commits a felony.
Oh.
And it's all over.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like it's the attention.
It's so hard to be the Charles Carroll's back in the TV to show you something good about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all different. And I think that the politics right now and our Congress and Senate, I'm thinking, what is it that we could do as women or as people that would be just man and woman that would change what's going on in the country? And how would that, what would that look like? A woman is different than the woman we're talking about instead.
Mm-hmm.
What what do we have as people as some kind of power to change in a positive way?
And what's the critical mass of people, or, you know, I guess that's the other thing that intrigues me. What's the nature of the moral authority? Where did this moral authority come from that kind of persuaded the people in the, you know, negotiation rooms to change their minds or to switch direction?
Because I think one of the powerful things of seeing something like this is it speaks to us as people, as to not just what happened there, but what does that say to us about what we should be doing and where we should go?
Yeah. So one reason I included this as part of this, my series on sort of religion and politics in Africa, because I feel even though they focus more on these women as mothers and sort of as feminine politics, I think it was also significant the role that religious belief played in this, and the religious beliefs of the men who were being persuaded. I think it wasn't just this dog whistle of the mother's voice, but I think also a respect for sort of, I don't really get into ancestors and spirits and stuff, but God, or just a sense that there are broader repercussions for the evil they're committing. I guess I'd like to think that conscience is not just, their mothers. But the other thing is African culture, this phenomenon, actually, there's other instances of this in West African history, of women being the leaders and sort of shaming the powers that be into changing their behaviors. You mentioned one in the Niger Delta in Nigeria. Women became leaders, leading movers in the Ogoni people movement there. Other people have talked about during the colonial period when British colonized Nigeria and West Africa, often it was the women who would get riled up because there would be some colonial law that favored men over women or would disrupt the women's market activity, and then these women would just get up. But then they would use these tactics and strategies that were very African. I mean, had kind of long, ancient roots, things that they would do, like they would have been stripping in the form of protest. Along those lines, I mean, in these books I recommend it if you want to read more sort of scholarly analysis of this kind of thing. I think these are both because they're collections of essays by various scholars who investigate cases from around Africa of this kind of phenomenon where sort of people that seem to be in the margins who sort of organize and employ guilt, if you will, or religious power, religious authority, as well as Satyagraha, if you will, and how they employ this in different parts. So here the one book, Development, Politics, and Below, Exploring Religious Spaces in the African State, talks about different cases in Africa where religion plays a role that might be surprising from a Western audience, from a Western perspective, like why is it these religious figures have such influence. And then the second one, there, Evangelical Christianity and Democracy in Africa, is specifically talking about Evangelical Christianity, edited by Ranger, but looking at parts of Africa, Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, Uganda, in particular Zambia, where the presidents are sort of very outwardly evangelical Christian, and are very and plays a role in the legislation and so on. So I don't know. We didn't reserve a lot of time for discussion. I don't know if there's any comments or questions.
Documentary at one point, not in this segment show here, but in documentary indicated that Charles Taylor was a Christian. And I just wonder, not knowing the history, I suspect he rode the ropes or the coattails of the Christians to power.
Mm.
And, at the crisis point, the church, the women of the church, who did a lot of the work, pulled the rug out from under it.
Right.
And
he kind of lost.
I don't know what all the dynamics are in that. That's a guess.
No, I think you're right. I think but I'm not sure I'm going to be sort of bought that anyways. I mean, with him saying he was doing this as part of a divine calling, I think anyone who's a member of a church would believe that. But
I think he kind of used the church as a tool.
Right. Yeah. But it goes back to Liberian history. In many parts of Africa, they were colonized by Westerners. In the case of Liberia, it was African Americans, but they were all, it was all church related in a sense. It was colonized by African American Christians who made Christianity a central part of the government and the society. So I think by the time Charles Taylor was around, it was just sort of assumed that the president was also going to be Christian. Part of the language of power was, referencing God and saying that God is on our side. So I think you're right, that you lost that authority pretty quick. Comments, questions?
Thank you.
run out of time, but all right, well, thank you for attention. And
thank you.